Son of a gun out there. And I hope you found yourself somewhere cool to listen to the program. Now it hit 100 degrees up here this week. It was over 120 something down the hill. But regardless of the heat, I'm happy to have you here tonight because I have a whopper of a show scheduled for this evening. A little of this and a little of that. It's safe to say that there's something here for everyone. So let's go ahead and get started. But first, real fast, I can't help but notice the show has been growing the past couple weeks. Thank you to all of those that have helped in that achievement. So with those brand new listeners in mind, here's the rub. Monsters Among Us is a call-in show, but not your normal call-in show. I have a 24/7, 365 hotline that folks can call in and report their encounters. Each week, I pull a few of these stories, and we discuss them here on the program. The subject matter can range from all sorts of things, but they all have one thing in common. These stories are said to all be true accounts. Take Devin's entry out of Texas, for example. Devin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Derek. Been listening to your show, starting back from season one. My name is Devin. I live in Denton, Texas. And this story is actually from my father, who's been saying this for, 16, 17 years around the campfire. My dad grew up in San Angelo, Texas. And this is a Goatman story. And he claims to have an experience one night back in 1984. And in those times, you were allowed to run around with guns and shoot squirrels and all that kind of stuff. His friend Robbie Overstreet was with him. They were camping one night in some secluded area, a lake or a giant pond or something like that. And these were not conformed camping sites. These were sites you could just go to and make your own camp. And one night, they went out as teenagers. So they went out one night and they thought they would take their new bows and make little stick arrows and mess with some of the people across the pond or small lake, whatever. And so they started doing that and they noticed the guys on the other side started noticing that and they pulled out their guns. So my dad and his friend started running back to their camp. As they started running back, they saw probably like a quarter mile away, something like that. Not too far. They could still see the campfire blazing across their trucks because they would park their trucks around the campfire. And they were running back and they saw some kind of being that wasn't, it was like, the way he described it was like a black, person. The light from the campfire was not blazing on them, so they couldn't see like who it was. And they started seeing like someone like throwing sand and dirt on the campfire, like trying to put it out. And when they got there, the campfire was almost out. And when he looked down, he saw, all the sand and residue was around the campfire. They saw a bunch of hoof prints. And the reason why I'm saying this is because your last episode was about Goatman. Now, I actually live in Denton, Texas. I went to high school at Lake Dallas. I'm right across the street from Old Alton Bridge. I've been there several times, so it just kind of reminded me about Goatman And, you know, my dad was in San Angelo, so it's a really far, long way. So I just wanted to tell you that story. My dad's been telling the story for a long time. And actually, back in 2016, my grandfather passed away. So I actually met his friend, Robbie Overstreet, who was there. And I asked him about it separately. And he's like, oh, yeah, that happened. I can't remember the time where I never forgot that. So I just wanted to share that. And love your podcast. I got other stories. I've had some crazy UFO encounters. But I'll call back when I'm ready, I guess. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Devin. Okay, let's go monster hunting. Well, we did some research, and it turns out that the area Devin's father had his experience in does indeed have a legendary creature in its lore. They call it the Lake Nosworthy Monster, and it's said to inhabit the waters of Lake Nosworthy, which is located just to the south of San Angelo. Now, Devin's father described a pond or small lake, so could this be that very same body of water? Now, at first, it might seem as though we struck gold, but here's where the wheels fall off. The description of the creature in Devin's call does not match the reports of the Nosworthy Monster, which has been described as a 6-foot-long, not tall, long, scaly creature that inhabits the waters of the lake. In other words, it seems to be a crocodilian of some sort. A gator, croc, caiman, etc. And Devin's father clearly described something upright and human-shaped and claimed that it left hoof tracks in the sand. Now, although I could not find any hoofed humanoid stories from the area of San Angelo, I do know plenty persist in the Lone Star State. For some reason, it seems that many of the monsters in that area seem to share one characteristic: cloven hooves. For example, take the Donkey Lady Bridge story out of San Antonio.
Shattered windshields, hoof prints, and neighing. Welcome to Donkey Lady Bridge, a ghost story that goes back decades.
A lady was badly burnt in a fire, and she was distorted, and her hands became almost to look like hoofs, and they were heavily scarred, and her face was elongated, and she sort of looked like a horse. She was coming across the bridge here with her donkey. Her donkey had attacked and hurt a little boy earlier or something along that line. The father came out here, the little boy. He caught the lady and the donkey going across the bridge.
Rumor has it that woman and her donkey were pushed off the bridge and died. Then, her spirit never left.
Or how about the legend Devin spoke of? The old Alton Bridge Goatman.
It's one of Denton's most legendary ghost stories, and most terrifying.
If you go there at night now, you could possibly see the goat man.
There was a man named Oscar Washburn. He was a goat farmer, and so he had decided that he was going to put a sign up on the bridge to direct them down the dirt path to this way to the goat man.
There's no official record of Washburn, but historians say he was killed in a race-motivated attack on this very bridge.
The legend goes that, you know, visiting the bridge is always kind of daring a visit with the goat man. Going onto the bridge and knocking 3 times. It's kind of a summons, or a dare, if you will.
And of course, in the Fort Worth area, occurring 54 years ago this month, the Lake Worth Monster.
A good spot for young folk to do what young folk do.
Rob Denkhouse is the manager of the Nature Center and took us to the old hangout spot where in 1969, something happened.
They heard some disturbance and then a loud scream. A tire, with a rim, mind you, came flying 500 feet off that ridge.
And when the crowd looked up,
they saw a creature up on top there.
Some who have seen it say it looks like a half man, half goat.
And it was hairy and I couldn't see his face. It was in the dark.
A local journalist chronicled in a book the drawings and newspaper clippings of the Lake Worth Goat Man. And Channel 8 was there the next day with a story now archived in the SMU Jones Library.
It was up there on those cliffs, and it'd stay up there running back and forth.
The skepticals say it's a man in a monkey suit, so tonight there will be more people back, armed with cameras and probably with rifles.
Now, those stories courtesy of KSAT, ABC News 12 out of San Antonio, KTVT, CBS News 11, and WFAA, ABC News 8 out of Dallas, respectively. So there you go, Devin. Your dad's not the only one that's experienced something like that. And most of those legends go back a ways. It's certainly got to count for something. So thanks again, Devin, for sharing your entry. Now, folks, if you have a true paranormal tale, please call our hotline at 1-888-608-NIGHT. That's 888-608-NIGHT. And don't forget, you can email me a recording made from your cell phone. Just send it to monstersamonguspodcast@gmail.com. And you know, folks, it's that time of the season again. Time to announce the theme to the Season 16 premiere episode. And this year, we're going to run one back. I had so much fun with this topic last time we addressed it that I just had to bring it back. So, calling all truckers, long haulers, bus drivers, delivery drivers, if your vehicle has more tires than it does seats, and you drive it for a living, you qualify, and I want to hear from you. Please give us a call at 888-608-NIGHT. And before you start your story, just say this is for the truck driver special. Then I'll use my fancy voice searchy thing and pull your call out of the sea of entries. Now, that special episode is only a few months away, so please don't hesitate to get that call in today. Now, next up, we venture to Nevada, where Vicky is waiting with an eerie entry.
Hi, my name is Vicky. I currently reside in Nevada, but I'm originally from Peoria, Illinois. I had grew up kind of experiencing things my entire life, just weird things, seeing things, feeling things, hearing things, voices, being touched, things like that. But it didn't really get bad until my parents passed away on June 22nd and 23rd of 2009. My parents passed away, both of them a day apart. And my mom had always joked with us whenever I was with certain friends that when she passed away, she would come back and mess with us. So I lived in her house for about 2 weeks after they passed away. Mind you, my dad directly passed on the couch that we could not remove because I just couldn't touch it. And then my mother, who had her initial episode of a heart attack at home, ended up passing at the hospital. So there's a couple different instances. There was one time that me and my friend were in the living room and we were just kind of hanging out, sitting in my mom's wheelchair, and the front door slammed closed. We lived in a shotgun house, and it was really nice outside. There was a little breezy, but nothing that would slam doors. Not only that, but with it being a shotgun house, usually if one door moves, then the other door will move just because of the way the airflow is and everything like that. My dad actually used to sleep next to the front door a lot, and he would always yell at us and tell us, "You weren't born in a barn. You need to close this door." So he would slam the door on us. So it very much reminded me of my dad, and that's initially who I thought, and it freaked me out, and I was just like, okay, that's enough. Just stop. Like, you're scaring me, you know. So it stopped for a while. There was another instance where my mother used to tap pens and stuff like that when she used to get frustrated. Well, I was talking to the same friends that she had told me she was going to mess with, and I start to hear a pen tapping in the room that used to be hers. Once again, scared the crap out of me. I was always in the habit of just stop. Just don't do that anymore. You're scaring me. I can't deal with it. You know, things like that. Just because I kind of had a feeling that it was my mother. Well, there was one house that we moved into shortly after, and I still experienced things that I attributed to my parents. But this one house, for some reason, it was fine, and then my brother moved in, who was like this big Christian guy, really into church, went every Sunday, and new things started happening. It was like he would hear a whisper in the kitchen area, and then the lights would go out. And the minute I would walk into the room, the lights would come back on. There were a bunch of other little things that went missing. There was a glass cross broken, numerous different things. And so we basically ended up finding out from a friend's mom later that it was not my mother, that there is supposedly something that follows me and makes things bad when they start to go good. So now that I'm living in Las Vegas and no longer are around those friends a lot, I don't really experience it a lot. Every so often, I'll, you know, on anniversary dates or things like that, I'll experience little things. My mom was a Halloween lover, so of course, Halloween night, for some reason, there's always something that happens. But I just figured I would share that with you. I've had ridiculous, crazy amounts of things happen. But that's just the things that stick out most in my mind. Definitely, if I have anything else, I will give you a call back. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicky, for the entry. You know, hauntings that are assumed to be that of loved ones. That's great and all, until you guess incorrectly. Of course, we have no scientific proof yet that ghosts even exist, and I'm not sure how much I believe in the phenomenon myself. But that thought will never leave my head. If that quote-unquote ghost that you thought was dear old mom was only pretending to be, that raises several questions. Who is it really? Why are they doing this? And what sort of danger might we be in? Just believe me when I say, never trust the dead. Now, of course, none of this is meant to discourage your experience, Vicky. Simply offering up a spooky alternative. And I can't imagine how traumatizing it would be to lose both parents in that short of a span of time. So for your sake, I certainly hope it's one or both of them coming back to keep an eye on things. And just be careful is all I'm saying. After all, you did mention that you lived in a shotgun house. And as I entertained last week, there seems to be some sort of paranormal connection to that type of structure. Now, regardless of all that, I'm so sorry for your loss, Vicky, but thank you for calling into the program. Now let's get back into the action, this time with Lindsay's entry out of Tennessee.
Hi, Derek. This is Lindsay. I am from East Tennessee, and my story takes place. It was probably back in 2008. I was with my mom and my youngest daughter, and we were actually going to go and find me a bridesmaid's dress for one of my best friend's weddings. And we went, we found the address, you know. Well, on our way back, we were getting off the exit to head to our house. And as we were getting off the exit, I seen this man standing there, which, you know, I'm assuming he was a hitchhiker because he had a sign that said something to the effects of "we'll work for food" or "homeless need food." And for some reason, when I made eye contact with this man, it was almost like, I can't even explain it. It was like this urge that I need to help this man, which, you know, all throughout the years, anytime I've ever seen a homeless person or a person in need, me and my husband both, you know, we would always stop, either give them money or help them with food, take them out to eat, so on and so forth. Well, when I seen this man, it was almost like he had a glow to him when I was looking at him, when he made eye contact with me. And I asked my mom, I was like, "Mom, can we please stop up here at this gas station? I feel like I need to help this man." And she was like, "You know, absolutely." So we pulled into the gas station. I go inside. I go and I get him, you know, corn dogs, some water, some snack cakes. I put some money into the bag. Well, as we're pulling out to pull around by the interstate to pull off to the side so I could get out of the car, this guy had his back toward me. And there is no possible way that he could have heard me, you know, because right there it's by the interstate, there's cars, it's loud, you know, so I'm pulling off to the side. I get out of the car and I'm probably a good maybe 50 to 100 feet away from him. And as I'm carrying this bag, I get this overwhelming sense of, like, happiness, but, like, emotional. Like, I got really, really emotional for some reason. And mind you, this guy's back is still facing me. And right before I get ready to touch his shoulder, he turns around and smiles at me. And he was like, you know, God bless you. Thank you. And, you know, of course, I was like, you know, you're welcome. Absolutely. You know, anything I can do to help. Well, as I do that and I give him the stuff, he puts his sign back in his bag. He picks up his big duffel bag. And as he's walking across the street or across the ramp to go into the woods, I am not joking when I say this, because I'm watching this man go, you know, in as he's walking into like the wood line, because it was pretty close to the ramp. Right before he goes into the wood line, he literally disappears. Like, it's almost like he vanished into thin air. And I was just stunned. I was like, did that really just happen right in front of me? I mean, he was just right before you get to the wood line, and he was just gone. It was almost like, I don't want to say a glitch, because it was just like he just evaporated. It was absolutely insane. And the craziest part is that as I am running back to my mom's truck, I get in the car, and my mom's eyes are as big as baseballs. And she was like, did that guy just disappear? And I was like, you saw that too? I was like, I thought I was seeing things. I thought my mind was playing tricks on me. And she was like, no, I seen him disappear. And I was like, oh my gosh, that is absolutely insane. I don't know who or what I encountered. My mom, God bless her soul, she passed away in 2013. But she seems to believe that we may have encountered like an angel of some sort. And I honestly, the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, that's a good possibility. And I mind you, that day was absolutely beautiful. It was July of 2008. It was sunny. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. I mean, it was a beautiful day. And I don't know, it's almost like the feeling that I had when I met this guy or seen this guy as I was coming off the ramp, and the way we made eye contact, it was almost like this something took over me. And then just the emotional feeling that I got from him, I can't even explain it. And I've never felt that way since. And I've helped, and I've, you know, encountered a lot of people in need and whatnot. But the way he just vanished into thin air, I'll never forget that. That was just, and for my mom to validate what I seen when I never even, you know, obviously didn't mention it to her because she seen it for herself. But I don't know. I'm not a very good storyteller, but I just figured I would share that because that was probably one of the most craziest things that ever happened to me or that I've experienced. But I just figured I'd share that one. That was the one that kind of popped into my head as I was listening to your podcast. Keep up the good work. I hope you can use this. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay. No good deed goes unpunished. At least that was my first thought. After all, she went out of her way to help someone in need. And in return, her world was rocked. Not a fair exchange, if you ask me. But then a thought crossed my mind. Perhaps this man's entire purpose was to distract Lindsay just long enough to avoid something tragic. A car accident, a carjacking, something unfortunate. She had mentioned the feeling of peace that overcame her as a result of coming near the man. Could this be another of those guardian angel stories we've heard so often here on the show? That certainly could explain this man's strange behavior. And this is, by all means, a strange story, but somehow still a bit touching. But truth be told, I can't help but be left with one nagging question. When he disappeared, did that corn dog disappear with him, or did it simply fall to the ground, just like they do in the movies? Thanks again, Lindsay, for sharing that puzzling and intriguing story. Now, folks, I have a big announcement to make. Finally, after a long delay, the Color Blast reorder is finally on its way. Now, if you pre-ordered one of these Color Blast shirts, it will be arriving here within the week. And if you're trying to snag a brand new one, keep an eye on the website, monstersamonguspodcast.com, and click the shop tab, or follow our social media for any updates. Now, I imagine these new ones will go pretty fast. After all, it's an amazing design by the talented Brett Manning, and a brilliant t-shirt pairing by my beautiful wife, Sarah. So with this shirt, you can't lose. Of course, the shop is fully stocked with all your other tried and true designs, all ready to ship out to you before this upcoming spooky season. So visit the site, click the shop tab, and order some gear today. So our next entry is an interesting one, not only because of the subject matter, but because of the source. Mackenzie from South Carolina, welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is Mackenzie. I'm calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and this isn't my story, but this is my boyfriend's story. He's a pilot, and he does a lot of flying over the coast, up and down, with students and with other pilots. And one day when they were flying, they were about at 2,500 feet, and it was, you know, clear blue skies. It was a perfect day. The weather was very smooth, and about 10 miles off the coast, him and his co-pilot saw this shiny kind of like ball-looking orb in the sky. And he was like, "Are you seeing this?" And his pilot, other co-pilot was like, "Yeah, like what is this?" And they were both completely puzzled, and so they kind of flew out toward it. Normally, things that are like on air traffic show up on the radar, but this was not on the radar at all, and so they were super confused. They thought maybe it was a weather balloon, but it looked too metallic for it to be that, and it was also just hovering there, but kind of like vibrating and moving back and forth, he said. And then he went to push his button down to call the air traffic control tower to see if there was any weather balloons in the area or something. And as soon as they looked back, it was gone. And he thinks that it went down into the ocean because he did not see it forward. He did not see it on the other side. And so, yeah, that's kind of crazy. But that's his story, and I wanted to share that because I'm convinced he saw a UFO, and he still to this day refuses to believe me. But, yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mackenzie. You see, I find this story interesting because I've heard it and even seen it before. And I find this source interesting because he's part of a small group we seldom hear reports from. I include pilots in the short list of professions that I rarely ever get a call from. Doctors, lawyers, federal employees. So in the rare occasion when one does call in, or in this case, someone calls for them, I sit up and take notice. And like I'd mentioned previously, I've seen something like this before, albeit on video. Now, I'd love to tell you more about the video, but I simply can't, because the info surrounding it is likely still classified. But I can tell you that this particular video was taken by a military surveillance drone somewhere over the Middle East. Now, the camera seems to be trained on a few people walking down a dusty, sunny road, when suddenly, a silver sphere, not unlike what Mackenzie's boyfriend described, comes flying into the frame. Now, the drone takes notice and tracks the perfectly cylindrical object for a few seconds as it shoots across the sky. Now, I've linked to the video, which was posted by ABC National News, over in the show notes. Go ahead and take a look. And Mackenzie, have your boyfriend take a look as well. Does this look familiar? And believe it or not, this is not the only silver sphere in UFO lore that we have to deal with. But we'll touch on all those at another time in a future broadcast. For now, let's just digest this little bit and say thank you to Mackenzie for sharing the entry. Well, folks, I have an even bigger announcement to make. At long last, David, Flora, and myself are proud, excited, and a little bit relieved to finally premiere our film, Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle. And get this, you're invited. We're holding a huge premiere event at the Rustic Theater in downtown Idlewild, California, essentially one of the points of the triangle. Now, the event will be held at 8:30 p.m. on the 17th of August. David and I will be there to introduce the film, and you can join us simply by claiming your free ticket via the link in tonight's show notes. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with this project, a few years ago, my friend and fellow podcast host, David Flora, and I launched a Kickstarter campaign to produce a feature film about the strange goings-on in a sparsely populated swath of desert here in Southern California, a place we started calling the Borrego Triangle. Well, despite a low budget and a global pandemic, we powered through, and at long last, it's ready for the world to view. So if you're a SoCal native or just love to travel, pick up your ticket now. It's an intimate theater, so seats are limited. And I promise, this event will sell out very shortly. And for all of you that cannot make it to the premiere, we are working diligently to get the film in a theater somewhere near you before the summer's end, and will release on streaming later this fall. So if you know someone with ties to a movie theater, put us in touch. We're exploring any and all avenues. So those are the details. And hopefully we see you at the movies. Now, the submitter of this next one probably wishes they were in a movie instead of in the experience they found themselves in. Please welcome this anonymous caller out of the state of Pennsylvania.
Hi, Derek. This story takes place in Doylestown, right outside of Philadelphia. Around 3 a.m., like 3-4 years ago at this point, I used to drive that road like every day. I would sneak my best friend out of their house because of a bunch of BS. And I would be driving down Swamp Road particularly. This road was supposed to be like really dangerous. Like if there was even a drop of water on the ground, there was this one particular hill that you could hit the ledge and just fly into this person's backyard, like something along the lines of like 3-4 stories down height-wise. So many people have died on it. But I don't think that's really what this creature is about. Up until this point, my friend I was talking about was dealing with a really aggressive land spirit that lived there. You know, the whole nine yards, like giving it things, it won't bother you for a while, comes back. It was terrifying. But around that time, like that was settling down, I picked them up one day, you know, normal again, like 3 a.m., and we're driving down Swamp Road. On the road, there's this one, like, intersection of another road called Dark Hollow. Dark Hollow has, like, some, you know, stories about it, like, a teacher was killed by his students because he was, like, a really bad guy in, like, the late 1700s, and a bunch of other kind of creepy stuff. But I don't know. So basically, I'm driving down. It's dark, but it's clear. And out of nowhere, this, like, small raccoon, like a baby raccoon, runs underneath my wheel. I hear myself hit it, like a bump, and just keep going. I try to stop, obviously. Like, raccoons are my favorite animal, and a baby I've never seen in person. So, like, and I've also never hit an animal before. I'm very vigilant about that, especially in deer country where this takes place. So, you know, I stop like a quarter of a mile down, slam my brakes, and get out. But when I get out, I kind of hear this noise, like, not to be weird, but like a yell. And I don't really care. I mean, I feel really uncomfortable, like I'm being watched from every corner around me. But I keep walking because I'm like so upset about hitting this thing. And remembered feeling the thump. I get to close enough to where, like, I would be able to see it under the street lamp. There's nothing there, no blood, nothing, like, no, like, tall grass moved or anything like that. It wasn't super high grass at the time. And as I make one step closer, I just start hearing this blood-curdling screaming coming from the forest on the other side of the road. And, like, this isn't a habited place. Like, there are houses every, like, mile and a half from each other. especially in this one section around Dark Hollow Road. And, like, the only people who live there are, like, 80 years old. And, like, no human being could have made this noise. I've heard foxes yell. I've heard weird animal noises. But nothing like this. It was high-pitched, humanoid, and just blood-curdling. I could barely move. I turned around and ran right back to my car. I don't really have an idea of what it was, but I know this sounds kind of less field, but because we were dealing with the land spirit and all that stuff, and it's, you know, a really historic area, I was thinking it could have been a skinwalker, because the land spirit is a very Native American myth, or Native American fact, in my opinion. And I don't know, like, I feel like a Native American presence is there, obviously, as it is everywhere in their country. And so, I don't know, I knew it was a skinwalker in my head. We ducked out of there so fast. But besides the point, I kind of wanted to use this as a call to arms, too, or because, like, I don't hear any stories about Bucks County, like, ever. And growing up here, it's one of the weirdest places I have ever been to. Like, I lived near Ben Franklin's, like, house where he, like, flew the thing, and that mansion was terrifying. Like, there is so much weird stuff, especially around Doylestown. Like, if you're from the area, I would love to hear any stories, because I know there's something going on here, and I don't know why more people aren't talking about it. Well, thanks for the podcast. I listen to it literally every week, and still haven't been to season one, but, you know, I'll get there. Thanks.
Thanks, caller. Look, I'll be honest. If you did hit an animal with your vehicle, I would fully expect to hear some moaning and thrashing on the roadside, even if it's in the weeds, just out of sight. Oftentimes, animals that are struck by vehicles are able to continue on for a bit before the adrenaline runs out and the pain moves in. And that too could explain why the moan and the scream came later and from deeper in the forest. Poor little fella. And in regards to your Bucks County call-out, I have to disagree with you, caller. We play calls from that area of the country all the time. But I do agree that there is something strange about that place. Just ask M. Night Shyamalan. Thanks again, caller, for sharing your entry. Well, folks, I have a couple more stories to share, so let's fire this next one up. Taking us back to the state of Texas, please join me in welcoming Robert to the program.
Hi, this is Robert in Texas. I have a story of a strange happening to me. I don't know what to check it up as, but here it is. In the mid-1990s, I was working as a paramedic in a small Texas town. My partner and I got a call late at night for a female having chest pains. We took off code 3, which means using our emergency lights and sirens. This was before GPS, so we had to rely on maps and mailbox numbers to find our location. The address we were going to was a very rural one, so there was no street lights, and it was a dark night, so it was very difficult to read the mailboxes. When we got to the general area of the call, we turned off the sirens as we tried to find the correct driveway. We took one and then realized we'd made a mistake, so we turned off the lights, emergency lights, as we backed up to the road and went to the correct driveway, the next one down. When we pulled up, we recognized the home as a residence where we ran a code on a male cardiac arrest patient a month or so before. In typical medical professional black humor fashion, we mentioned to each other this was probably the wife who was now having a heart attack and that she was going to go join her husband. We jumped out of the ambulance, we grabbed our medic bags, and we went inside. We found the patient having chest pains, but she was overall okay. I sent my partner back out to the ambulance to get the stretcher so that we could take her to the hospital to get checked out. When he returned, he had this strange, questioning look on his face. Still dealing with the patient, I didn't have time to ask him what was going on. So we placed her on the stretcher, took her out to the ambulance. As we came outside, I saw that the ambulance had nearly every light it was equipped with turned on. strobe lights, floodlights, interior lights, everything on. We loaded the patient and took her to the hospital. After the call, I asked my partner why he had turned on all the lights on the scene. He denies doing that, saying that didn't we turn everything off when we went into the wrong driveway? I said, yeah, we had. We only had the headlights on when we arrived at the patient's house. The interior lights of the ambulance come on when a door is open, so that is explained by my partner getting the stretcher out of the back. But neither of us recall activating the emergency lights, strobes, or floodlights when we arrived at the house. There was no real reason to do so. We had already gotten there. In the end, we sort of wrote it off as her dead husband letting her know that he was still there. I don't really have an explanation why, while the lights were on, they're controlled by a switch panel in the front seat of the ambulance. I suppose it's possible we hit it automatically when we jumped out, but we should have noticed the strobe lights when we unloaded our supplies. So, no real answer. That's the only really strange event in my life that I can recall. I do enjoy the podcast. Great stories and nice information. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. You know, my mom was an EMT for at least a decade, from about the mid-90s to the mid-aughts, maybe even later. You know, I should ask her if her ambulance was haunted. I know for a fact that a lot of people died, or nearly died, in that very unit, so I certainly would not be surprised. And it takes a special kind of person, the kind that I'm not, to do a job like this. It's gruesome, disgusting, and I'm sure heartbreaking. Now I commend my mom for her years of service. And you too, Robert. Thanks for taking care of folks and for sharing that bizarre entry. Well, that brings us to tonight's closer. And I'm a big fan of this next entry, so let's not waste any time in getting it started. Please join me in welcoming Mike from New England.
Hey, Derek. This is Mike. I'm from, I'd say, the tri-state area, New England. Maybe you wouldn't think it, but it's actually pretty rural, most areas around here. Just listening to your show, and it reminded me of this trippy story that I've been hearing from one of the kids that grew up a couple streets down from me. Just want to preface this by saying the type of kid that experienced this and told this story, he was, not to be condescending, but he had not really much of a personality. He was, just a real average kind of guy, not the type of person you would expect to recount some type of wild story or, you know, anything like that. He didn't believe in aliens, UFOs, nothing like that. He was a real run-of-the-mill, you know, kind of kid. And that's why this has stuck with me so much. I'd say probably about junior year of high school was the first time that I heard it. This occurred to him when he was maybe about 9 years old, 9 or 10 years old. And his family had a house, and out in the back of the house was kind of like, I don't know what you'd call it. It was like a wine cellar. They had a couple freezers down there, or ice boxes or whatever, for storing meat, you know, deer and stuff that they had killed or whatever. And this was out in the back of the house. It was like a stairwell that led down to this kind of a little basement area. And I've seen the house myself before. So anyways, when he was, like I said, about that age, 9 or 10, he's out in the backyard playing around. And for whatever reason, he wanders down into this cellar. And he gets down to the bottom of the stairs and looks over to where there's these two long ice boxes sitting on, you know, over on one side of the cellar. From what he describes, it was like almost like a guy that looked like a cross between Quasimodo and Chunk from the Goonies, just like a real messed up looking big dude, you know, contorted face and the whole nine yards. And this guy is, he's got the ice box open, and he's just stuffing raw meat in his mouth. He's just getting into that raw meat that they had down there in the ice boxes. Needless to say, he turned tail and he ran to the top of the stairs of the cellar. And he says he remembers trying to open the door to get out, and it felt like it was locked, and turning around and seeing this guy kind of looking at him and slowly walking towards him. He's hammering on the doorknob. He's freaking out. And then it just finally pops open. He runs out into the yard, screaming and crying, goes, tells his parents. His father comes out, has a look around, and the father wasn't able to find anybody, but they were able to see that somebody had been in that icebox eating on that raw meat. So I always just thought it was a wild story. Totally forgot about it. Just listening to your podcast is what brought it back to mind. Like I said, just the type of kid that told this story. In my personal opinion, there's no way in a million years that he was just fabricating this or telling it for the hell of it. I've always got freaked out every time I heard about it. A lot of kids around here that were my age at the time, we all knew about the story, and just felt like it was worth mentioning. Peace and love.
What the hell do you call that thing? A caveman. A brute. A wild man. Thanks, Mike, for the call. You know, a few weeks back, we talked about a hunchback creature ding-dong ditching a dude out west here. Is it something like that? Or, friend of the program, local researcher and TV host Ronnie LeBlanc claims Sasquatch roams those parts of New England. Maybe that cryptic creature could explain this conundrum. But Mike never mentioned a hump, and he didn't describe the figure to be covered in hair. Which leads me back to the term, wild man. But even that term can be tricky, because many older reports use that term to describe what most would likely call a Sasquatch or Bigfoot encounter these days. But believe it or not, that tri-state area has a history of those types of sightings. And they're careful not to describe the creature in question as an 8-foot hairy giant, but rather exactly as the term would imply. A wild man. A feral human. Someone living on the outskirts of society. Think Wrong Turn, or The Hills Have Eyes. Now there have been several flaps reported in that tri-state area. Flaps that go back nearly 130 years. Reports like this one, from the Scranton Tribune, published on August 26, 1895.
Wild man seen again. A big hunt for the mysterious creature to start from Winsted today. Winsted, Connecticut, August 25th. The wild man in Colebrook has been seen again, this time by Morris Paflin, a well-to-do farmer of Colebrook, who owns one of the largest farms in the Litchfield Hills. While on his way here yesterday, he saw the wild man eating blackberries in the berry patch near the Holmes farm. Mr. Paflin got a good view of the hermit and describes his features, as did head selectman Riley W. Smith, who saw the man in about the same locality a week ago today eating berries. Paflin's story so terrorized the inhabitants of Colebrook that they came here in groups today and by roundabout ways. They did not dare to leave their homes unless armed.
Now that report read by Jeremy at the Sasquatch Discovery Project over on YouTube. And believe it or not, another report of a wild man in northern Connecticut surfaced just a few weeks later out of an Iowa newspaper. Now I've linked to Jeremy's full report on this flap in the show notes. So check out his video for that second story and for the other details. But you know, I will admit, some of these claims are a little strange. For example, that Scranton Tribune piece goes on to describe the wild man running like a deer while shooting at bystanders with a firearm. and that Iowa piece details the wild man moving about on all fours, not the same that was reported out of Scranton. Still, it's a bit unusual to hear so many reports of wild men in that area of the East Coast. Add to that another string of sightings in the 1970s, and it becomes frequent enough to cause the curious-minded to connect a few dots. And get this. At least one of those sightings in the 1970s detailed the wild man killing and devouring a white-tailed deer. Raw. And all this talk of eating raw meat reminds me of something that was making its rounds on all the paranormal pages just a few weeks back. Back in February of 2021, a nurse in British Columbia, Canada, found a dead deer while she was riding her horses. Curious, her and her grandfather decided to train a camera on the carcass to see what sort of wildlife it might attract. Instead, what she found shocked her. And when it leaked to the world back in May of this year, it also shocked the Western world.
Karenia Stanhope, who lives near the Powell River in Canada, started recording the area with her camera, wondering what kind of predators this place would attract when she found a dead deer on her property. The nature-loving woman was shocked by the scene she saw when she examined the footage she recorded. The footage showed two topless women eating deer carcass. According to the News and Mirror, it is seen in the records that two half-naked, pale-haired and neglected women squatted on the dead deer. She was horrified by what she saw in the footage of the camera she set up 2 minutes from her home. In the video, one of the women takes the deer's hoof in her mouth. Karenia described what she saw. It's not clear from the photos, but one of the women put the hoof right in her mouth.
Now that coverage courtesy of Your World over on YouTube. Now you know, every bit of coverage that I could find on this story seemed to label these hungry photo bombers as witches. Yet there seems to be zero evidence of that being the case. There was nothing in the image to indicate any sort of witchcraft practice whatsoever. All we really know is that there are two figures kneeling over a deer's remains, and they're seemingly putting pieces into their mouth. The still images released make it difficult to make out exactly what it is that's happening. But both figures seem to be missing clothing. The woman in the front is nearly nude, save for a loincloth and a cheap Halloween wig. And the figure in the back is more obscured, but seems to be shirtless, but wearing jeans and hiking boots. And perhaps another cheap wig. Now I've linked to a couple pieces of media if you'd like to dig deeper. But I think the story does a good job of giving us yet another possibility to explain what Mike's friend witnessed that day. Maybe it was just some weirdo doing weird things. As you heard in that previous clip, that sort of thing tends to happen from time to time. Regardless of the culprit, I love the story, Mike. So thank you for sharing it with us. And thank you, dear listeners, for taking this little ride. I hope you didn't bite off more than you can chew. And that's going to do it for this episode. Monsters Among Us is written and produced by me, Derek Hayes. Copyright Red Crow Media. Additional support is provided by Sarah Carter Hayes and Delaney Bowers. All media used in this production is done so under the protection of fair use. And if you like the show and are looking for more, why not join our social media pages? And while you're at it, head on over to YouTube and give us a like and follow there. And if you're still feeling randy, why not leave us a rate and review anywhere that sort of thing is possible? Don't forget, you can catch us Tuesdays and Thursdays at 9 p.m. on Sundown 96.6. And again on Saturdays at 11 p.m. Eastern on the UnX Network. And finally, tonight's score was provided by Iron Cthulhu Apocalypse, Co.AG Music, and Carl Casey at White Bat Audio. Thank you all for tuning in. Stay cool out there. Keep it spooky. And I'll find you all back here next week. Have a good night. Tonight's secret entry just might teach us a thing or two. Rebecca from Kansas. Welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Rebecca from Southern Kansas. My story happened a couple of years ago, and I guess I should preface this by saying that I am an amateur ghost hunter, so I've been to multiple locations all over the U.S., stayed the night, tried to find ghosts, and I am a skeptic. Even though I've tried everything that I have experienced, I can kind of brush off or give a scientific explanation for it. So I still enjoy doing it. I still think it's fun, but I've never seen anything spooky, unfortunately. But my family knows that I enjoy it. I often take them with me to do things like that. But my mother-in-law is a devout Christian and does not believe in ghosts. So she kind of has implied on numerous occasions that ghost hunting is kind of a satanic thing because there are no ghosts. All the good people went to heaven, so you're just chasing around demons if there are any here. So she has a husband, and the husband dies, and she decides she's going to sell her house and move. So she clears out her house and buys a house in a different state, and she only comes back to visit occasionally, but since her house has never been sold, it's still sitting there for sale. She comes and she'll stay in the sunroom. She's got a cot set up there, and she'll sleep there and visit family and then go back home. And the whole house is empty except for that one room where she has her little hideaway bed thing. And it's all hardwood floors. So, November, a couple years ago, she came and visited. She was by herself, and she was making her bed, and she thought she saw something move. So she looked up, and she was thinking at this point that maybe it's just a glare going across her glasses. And she looks up, and she still sees, and she says it's a dark figure. It's just completely black. It's only got the top half, and it's staring at her. And so it moves, and she is just in complete disbelief. She does not believe in things like this. So she follows the black figure across three rooms, and it finally turns and disappears into a bedroom. She follows it into the bedroom and takes her back and goes against the wall all the way to the closet to make sure that there's not somebody in her home. And so she doesn't see anything. She doesn't find anything. And she tells me the next day what she has seen. I think the reason why she shared it with me is because I like this kind of stuff. But she calls her sister, and her sister says, that's a demon. That is no good. Like, you know, it's just, and I'm like, well, maybe it's a good ghost. Maybe, you know, it was her husband that had recently passed, who I adored. And so I'm like, well, maybe we should figure out if it's good or bad. So I look on YouTube, and I see this energy worker explain to me that you can pick up the energy in a room by placing a lemon there. You place a perfectly good lemon in the room, and you leave it untouched. And over the weeks, you'll see if it just shrivels up on the inside, you know, and turns a kind of a darker yellow, but it's all still yellow. It's still, you know, not rotted or anything. And that's good energy. But if the lemon creates mold and rots, then it's negative energy in the room. So I go, I take my ghost hunting skills, and I go get 10 of the best looking lemons I've ever seen without any blemishes or anything. And I put them in every room on the main floor of this house. And I leave them for 6 weeks. And this is winter. She has the thermostat at the lowest setting just to keep the pipes from bursting. But it's cold. It's cold in that house. And nobody's there. And they're all new hardwood floors. So I leave them. 6 weeks, I come back. And I'm in the kitchen. That's the first room I'm in. And the lemon looks perfect. It looks really good. I go to the next room, which is the dining room. And that was the first place she saw the figure. And the lemon is rotted. And I follow the trail of where the thing, the entity, whatever, would have gone. And the three lemons across the three rooms are all rotted. So then I go pick up all the other lemons, and they're all perfect. They're all perfectly good. And I'll send you a picture. I took a picture of the lemons, and I'll send it to you. But I don't have an explanation for that. I mean, it was all kind of, in my mind, scientific. You know, I put it all on hardwood floors in the middle of every room. The temperature was set in a low setting. So, I mean, we're talking, what, 50, 55 degrees at the most that it got during this time? And nobody had any access to the house except for me for those 6 weeks. She didn't come back, and nobody came in or out. So, I don't know. I just thought it was a weird experience, and I highly encourage all of you to get your lemons out and see your energy. Thanks.
Well, Rebecca, I'm a skeptic as well, and I always look for rational explanations before I even entertain a paranormal one, as should all of us. And in applying that practice, I thought of a reason why only certain lemons would rot over others. Now, I don't know the particular layout of the house, nor the direction that your mother-in-law's windows face, but I'm wondering if sunlight shining through the window hit only certain lemons daily, speeding up their decomposition process while allowing the remaining lemons to rot at a slower rate out of the sun's harmful rays. Now again, without seeing that layout, it's hard to say for sure if this hypothesis is even possible, but it certainly makes sense in my head. And as for lemons themselves, the fruit is actually prominent in certain spiritual circles. For example, in Hindu legend, a demon named Nimbasura was once blessed by both Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. However, Nimbasura caused a famine across the land, and goddess Shankambari set out to kill the demon. Before she could slay him, Nimbasura realized the errors of his ways and asked to be seated at her feet, humbly, in the afterlife. As a result, she offered to turn him into a lemon, which is an intensely sacred fruit in Hinduism. Lemons are often placed throughout temples and homes to keep evil energies at bay. And lemons are used heavily in feng shui, often believed to have the power to absorb negative energies. So you just might be onto something here, Rebecca. And we thank you for that introduction. Now if we toss in a little mignonette, a few fresh oysters, we'll have ourselves a tasty little snack. Thanks again, Rebecca, for the entry. And thanks for making me hungry. And on that note, folks, let's kick it on over to the beyond. If you'd like to join us for this bonus content, simply visit patreon.com and search for Old Monsters Among Us podcast. Then sign up for one of our tiers, and boom, instant access to nearly 100 hours of additional content. And now Patreon makes it even easier by offering the first week absolutely free. So, in reality, you have nothing to lose. Why not join us today? Tonight's bonus content is going to be just a little bit different. You see, there are a few subjects here on the show that I do my best to shy away from, and sleep paralysis is one of them. Sure, the stories are creepy, but for the most part, we already know what's happening here. We know it's a sleep disorder. We know how folks are affected, and we know what to expect. But that doesn't stop people from sharing their experiences with the terrifying disorder. And that doesn't stop the experiences, and in turn, the stories, from being downright nightmare-inducing themselves. So tonight, I'm going to pull from that folder in what may well become a reoccurring segment that I'm going to call the Sleep Paralysis Files. So please, welcome the following sleep paralysis victims to the program in the first ever Sleep Paralysis Files.
Hey, this is Adam from Georgia. I called before with a story about a beer bottle and a doorknob, but I wanted to call. I've been listening to the podcast and been bringing up a lot of memories. Like I said before, I've had a lot of experiences. I feel like I'm a little bit more in tune with this kind of stuff than your average person, I guess, which sucks because I don't want to be. It all freaks me out. But when I was probably 4 maybe 5 years old. We used to live in this apartment complex. It was like little duplexes, and it was the middle of the night, and I woke up, and I couldn't move, and I was freaked out. I know now it was sleep paralysis, but at the time, I didn't see anything, but my bedroom door slowly opened.